You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. With Mark Bowman, we'll be breaking down every aspect and facet of the Atlanta Braves' Craig Kimbrel deal. With Joe Fusaro, we'll be overreacting to an 0-3 start and talking about Giancarlo Stanton and the bottom of the order. With Anthony DiComo, we'll be talking Mets and looking at Bartolo Colon, the bullpen, and the top of the lineup. With Todd Zielecki, talking Phillies and taking a look at Jonathan Papelbon, his presumed successor Ken Giles, and the slow-starting Cole Hamels. And with Bill Ladson, we'll be talking Nationals, looking at what to do about a slow-starting offense, how they set up the bullpen, and what they'll do in the leadoff spot. Talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter Bill Ladson. Bill, it's the special overreact to the smallest possible sample size edition of MLB.com Extras, so we're going to be doing a little bit of that. Nats start the season by scoring 3 runs in 2 games. Again, we're making too much of nothing, but if there was a worry about this club particularly early, this was it, right?
I would say so. There's no question about it. I told you this earlier in spring training that the offense was the thing I'm most concerned about. And Matt Williams also said that he wants to be able to get the easy RBIs. And obviously they haven't been able to do that, so far in 2 games. I mean, they're 0-for-11 with runners in scoring position. So it's really the same old story, you know, regarding last spring, postseason. So it's the same problems. And how they fix it, I have no idea. I mean, I can't say that they're not trying. They're really working hard and trying to get better, but they're just having a problem scoring with runs and scoring position.
Well, you just answered my next question. I'm going to ask it again anyway.
Sure.
The simplest, obvious, and best fix is just to get healthy, and that is going to happen, presumably. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I mean, are there adjustments to the kind of at-bats guys take? Are there part of it is just bodies. They need to get these guys healthy, but either tactically, strategically, is there anything they can do other than just say, look, it's 2 games and we know this is a good ball club?
I think they are putting too much pressure on themselves. I know they lost 3 major players in Rendon, Span, and Jason Worth, and 2 of them will be back soon. So, I mean, I think they have to realize, hey, just get the job done, be patient. And I think that will get it done. I mean, I cannot blame Matt Williams for what he's done. I mean, I think it comes down to the players. And I think hopefully by today they can get it done. Now, it's going to be tough against Harvey, but you just never know.
On the flip side, the rotation looks entirely as advertised, again, overreacting to a very short amount of time. Have you
sure.
seen what you expected to see from Max Scherzer and Jordan Zimmermann?
It's the same thing, man. It's just like they just need run support. I mean, Max Scherzer was great. I mean, the reason he lost the opener was because of defense. And Jordan Zimmermann had problems with his slider early on. But, that's a guy I never worry about because he figures it out after, a couple of innings. And then, he was really great after that.
Continuing with overreacting to minuscule sample sizes, the bullpen looks pretty strong very early. I do think it's fair to have a worry about what happens in right-handed setup, having lost a couple of guys, and then one of the guys they brought in, Casey Jansen, is hurt. What are they going to do as far as the right-handed side of setup relief while they are without Jansen?
I think it's pretty simple, Matthew. I told you this again early in spring training. Blake Treinen is going to be the eighth inning guy. I think he's a great move. I mean, they actually see him as a future closer. If Storen doesn't get the job done, believe me when I tell you, Blake Treinen is going to be that closer. And they really impressed with his breaking stuff. His fastball is clocked as high as 95 miles per hour. So I'm telling you, I'm not worried about the bullpen, believe it or not. I just think that they have the right guy in Blake Treinen, and they really believe in him. And I think he's going to be the guy you're looking at to really help this team out.
How does Tanner Roark fit in there?
Well, it's going to be a combination of things. It's going to be long relief. He could come in the short relief as well, like in the eighth inning or the seventh inning. So it's going to be interesting. That's how he fits in. I mean, the guy had a great season as a starter, but because of Scherzer, he has to be in that bullpen. And so far, so good. He's accepted the role. I mean, one thing they can't afford is another Ross Detweiler, where the guy was soaking all year long. And I don't think that's going to happen with Tanner Roark.
Is there any need to keep him at least somewhat stretched out for when the time comes that you need a sixth starter? Or is the sixth starter for this club in the AAA rotation instead of being Roark?
Well, I think it will be Roark as of right now. But it depends. I mean, if they get an injury, there's no question that Roark will be, you know, the guy taking a spot if one of the pitchers are hurt. So I'm expecting Matt Williams to really handle Roark really carefully. He did say he's going to have many roles in the bullpen, but it's going to be interesting to see how far they go when it comes to Roark.
Give us the injury rundown, starting with Anthony Rendon. Where is he at right now?
Nobody knows, Matthew. I mean, as Matt Williams said, it's a week-to-week type thing. You know, I'm predicting that it could be June when he comes back. I mean, this is a serious MCL injury. I mean, nothing is torn or anything, but it's taken so long to get it done. I mean, he injured the knee March 9th against the Braves. So, I mean, I'm expecting him not to be back for a while, and that's about it.
And what about Jason Worth? That sounds like it's fairly encouraging.
Yes, very encouraging. He's going to be have a rehab assignment starting today with Potomac, and that's good news. We probably see him the first game in Boston. In terms of Denard Span, he's much better than anyone anticipated. He's looking at probably the end of April. And I'm telling you, he's really working his butt off, and he's looked real, real good. He can hit. The thing was running, and so far, so good with the running. And, you know, we got to wait and see what happens.
To sort of circle back to the questions about the kind of broad questions about the offense, it seems like one possible, not a fix, because it doesn't matter that much, but one possible thing to look at is lineup construction. The reason I ask is, Michael Taylor is a guy with a lot of ability, and he can do a lot of things, but he doesn't seem to be your typical table setter, leadoff guy. What has gone into him being the leadoff guy early in the year?
Well, number one, his power, get a quick run, according to Matt Williams. He has the speed. The guy can run. So that's why they're doing it. They really don't have anyone right now who can steal the bases other than, you know, Michael Taylor. So hopefully, you know, by the time Span gets back, or even Jason Worth, I should say, they'll probably put Taylor down the lineup and have Worth the leadoff hitter. I'm telling you, Worth can be a great leadoff hitter. He did it in 2012 after he came back from the wrist injury, and he was phenomenal, man. They had an on-base percentage close to 400. The guy is that good as a leadoff hitter. Should have been that way really from day one, to be honest with you. So we'll see what happens, but I'm expecting Worth to be that leadoff hitter when it's all said and done.
I was just about to ask you about that. I mean, is he open to that? Because he's clearly got the skill set. He's got some power, but he's not a guy who swings for the fences. He certainly would seem to have that ability. I realize it's the manager's choice, but also the manager doesn't do that with a veteran like that without making sure he's bought in. Would Worth buy in? Was that something that you could see happening?
There's no question. He did it for Davey Johnson. I don't see it any different than with Matt Williams, to be honest with you. And I'm expecting Worth will do anything to help this team win. I mean, like Bryce Harper, although he doesn't say it out loud like Harper, he wants to win another championship badly. So he will do anything to help this team win. He did it in 2012. And after he came back from the wrist injury, I think he'll do it again.
You mentioned Harper and continuing with the overreacting to tiny sample sizes, he's looked awfully good early, hasn't he?
No question about it, Matthew. And you know what I like about Harper right now? He's going the other way. He's not trying to pull everything. And he had two hits yesterday, both to the opposite field. And I like the way he's going about it. I mean, he knows that he can't afford to strike out a lot, which he will. But, I mean, he's really trying hard to be an all-complete player.
You keep setting me up beautifully, Bill. I'm wondering, when you look at Harper, you know, he's shown nearly every skill at some point. He's certainly shown power. He's shown strike zone discipline. Mm-hmm. He's shown defensive tools. He's shown base running. The one thing he hasn't really shown at the big league level is a top-level hit tool. Do you think there's a 300 hitter in there, if not this year in his career? Do you think he's a guy who can hit for average, or do you think he's going to be a guy who's maybe a 270 hitter who does everything else? And that, don't get me wrong, that's a great player. 270 with walks and power and defense,
right,
is a great player. But do you think there's a 300 hitter in there?
Yes, I do. And you know what? I think as long as he has his father by his side, I think Bryce Harper, you know, will be a 300 hitter one day. I just think right now, like the rest of the hitters, they're trying to do a little too much because of all the injuries that they've had. But once things are back to normal, I expect Bryce Harper to have that high average and driving a lot of runs. I'm already high on him in terms of hitting home runs, driving in runs. I'm expecting the average to be even way up there when it's all said and done.
All right. Well, Bill Ladson, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves beat reporter Mark Bowman. Mark, the Braves finally did what I think a lot of people had been arguing for them to do, and a lot of people were terrified they were going to do for nearly all winter, and cashed in on a guy with enormous trade value and maybe not a ton of actual value to the 2015 Braves, Craig Kimbrel. First, just broadly, what was it that got them to that point that they were willing to do something that really nearly all winter they said they weren't going to do?
I think there was the point that you touched on that here. This is a club. Look, they know they're not going to win this division. You know, maybe they can flirt with 80 to, you know, right there around the 500 mark. What is the value in with a closer on that kind of club? But at the end of the day, the impetus behind this deal was simply, they have tried and tried and tried to move Melvin up in Junior's contract all winter. The only way they were going to move it, they realized, was to attach Craig Kimbrel to the deal. It's one that, you know, not only did they give up a great closer, they gave up a great clubhouse guy. I just talked to John Hart here just a few minutes ago, and this is. You know, days later, and he still says, "Hey, look, this is probably the hardest trade I've ever had to make." He said something about, he thought the Kenny Lofton deal that he made to the Braves back in 1997 when he was with the Indians, he hated giving up that guy. But, and he didn't even have a lot of time to get to know Craig Kimbrel. But at the same time, this was the right deal for the Braves in so many different ways. You know, it frees them up financially. From the financial aspect, the burden of Upton's contract is gone. You never know. The lifespan of a closer is volatile. You know, maybe Craig Kimbrel does prove to be one of those special guys, but those special guys are few and far between that are able to do it at that level for that length of time. And you know, like you said, you know, what is the value if you're not going to be, you know, a 90-win team? So brighten their future a little bit more with this deal.
Here's one of the questions to me, and you know, this was not just a salary dump. They brought in some real talent here, but and I think they've done that a lot this winter. But to me, the interesting question with the Upton contract is, this is not really a high payroll club. I don't think there's a question they couldn't have paid him. Now, I realize you don't want to pay a guy you're not playing, but the question to me is, they're presumably not going to spend that money this year because there are no free agents left. But is that cleared payroll space going to be rolled into the 2016 and 2017 rosters? Is moving this deal going to allow them to be competitive again quicker, or is it just a matter of getting out from under a bad contract?
I think there is going to be some flexibility there. Without using a specific number, just because there are some variables, but if you look at the guys that they have locked up, and maybe throw in a couple of the ARB guys, you know where they're going to be and project where ARB numbers are going to be. There's still around $65 to $70 million commitment both in the next 2 years, and we're talking basically nine to ten guys. You know, so that leaves you limited flexibility with their payroll. If it remains around $100 million, I do expect it to go up a little bit. We don't know exactly how much, but let's say you had Upton's contract still in there. That $15 million, when you don't expect to get much value out of the player over the remainder of his contract, just providing that a little bit extra flexibility, yeah, I do expect them to be players, whether it's via trade, the free agent market. Obviously, the fans are going to say, well, if you need a bat in the free agent market next year, you know, the two guys are going to be Justin Upton and Jason Hayward. I don't necessarily expect either of those guys to come back, you know, but at the same time, the Braves are going to have the financial flexibility to go after guys, you know, via trades, you know, that maybe they couldn't have had they continued to be burdened by BJ's contract.
Well, one thing I was struck by as they began, as comments started coming out and people started talking about what this deal meant and where the Braves were going to go, I was really struck by the fact that it doesn't seem that Cameron Maben steps in and becomes a center fielder. Maybe I'm out of step with everybody. I think this guy's a really good ball player, and the numbers in San Diego kind of don't do him justice, but I think that's a tough ballpark for him. What's the thought process with Maben? Was he just a guy to kind of balance this out, or is he at least going to have the opportunity to play himself into being something close to an everyday center fielder?
Yeah, I think from a financial aspect, he somewhat balanced it out, but at the same time, unlike Carlos Quentin, he provides some value. When I say Carlos Quentin, he truly was just a guy that just that balanced out the financial aspects of the deal. With Maben, you know, truth be told, you know what I think Maben needs to do? I think he needs to come here and start to play a little bit and show Freddie Gonzalez he's not still the young kid that he had when he was managing him with the Marlins. I think Freddie still envisions him as that guy. And for now, you know, he views his role as a guy who will get some starts against some left-handed starters and be used as a defensive replacement, whereas, you know, he'll enter games when the Braves have the lead late, go play center, and Eric Young Jr. will go to left. It, you know, improves you at both positions there in the late innings. But, yeah, I think, as you said, maybe he's still young enough. He's had some injuries. He was hurt by the ballpark he played in the last couple of years. I wouldn't be surprised if this guy tries. He's a North Carolina kid. He's really excited about this opportunity. He seems to be a very likable guy, a guy who brings some energy to the ballpark. So, yeah, maybe he does prove to be one of the surprises this year. But at the same time, I think what's going to happen is he's going to have to prove himself to Freddie Gonzalez, because it feels like Freddie still views him as the kid who struggled when he played for him when they were together with the Marlins.
So Eric Young Jr. is still the primary center fielder for now?
I'm starting to think that Eric Young Jr. is to you like Kiasco is to me. You know, you don't like him, and I don't like Kiasco. But, no, I mean, for now, yes. You know, they don't have any other options. Hey, look, maybe Maben can play himself into that role. At least Freddie did put Maben in, you know, there at on Wednesday night there at the season or the series finale against the Marlins. He's talking about starting him Friday night against the left end when the Mets throw Jonathan Neese. The one attraction that Eric Young brings is that they feel he is the one legitimate leadoff option they have. But hey, look, if you have a .640 on base percentage, then, you know, you're not an, it doesn't matter how fast you are or what traits you have to be a leadoff hitter.
I guess my thought with Maben, and to me the reason he's intriguing, is he's potentially under team control for two more years. And he's making a decent amount of money. He's making seven this year, eight, and the option is for nine. But if he's even a pretty good hitter and a plus center fielder, that's not a bad contract. And to me it just seems like maybe it's a long shot, but this guy might actually be the center fielder for your next good team. He's young. He's shown a broad base of skills at various times. Again, I like him more than most people. I understand that. But even if it's a 10 or 20% chance, there is some percentage chance that when this 16, 17, when they are sort of reconstructed and ready to go forward, it's not inconceivable that this guy could be the center fielder. So is that, I guess what I would ask is that part of the thought process, at least at the organizational level, if not the manager's level, that even if it's a long shot, this guy is potentially a long-term asset?
Yeah, I think that they view that as a possibility. I think that maybe you have maybe more faith in him than I've heard from others in the organization. For now, they kind of view him as a piece, a guy who, you know, can help provide some of that late inning flexibility. Here's a guy who, what? You know, coming up through 08, 09, probably as recently as that, he was one of the top 10 overall prospects in the game. He comes up and has some success and like you said, battled some injuries, and it's never a great for anyone to go to Petco Park and have to hit. So, and you know what? We're only a couple years removed. His last fully healthy season, I think he hit .262 with a respectable on base percentage. So, hey, maybe by the end of the year you'll be right, Matthew. Maybe he can be that guy. But right now, what I would say from the organization standpoint, I don't view them seeing him as the same kind of player that you do right now.
Wouldn't be the first or last time. We're running along, but I did want to one last thing, maybe the most obvious angle about this deal. What do they do in the late innings here? Is it just Grilly? Is it any element of mix and match? What do they do in the absence of Kimbrel at the back of the game?
Yeah, the Braves go out and they win three in a row, and people say, wow, you know. Hey, look, Julio Teheran, Alex Wood, Shelby Miller, that's pretty good. I mean, there are very few guys that are going to match up against, minus the Jordan Zimmermans, Clayton Kershaws, where you're going to, feel like they're overmatched, and they wouldn't be overmatched in those. But I'm just saying, hey, look, you send those guys to the mound, you feel good. What the Braves need to feel good about, or a little better, let's not say feel good about, feel better about, was that you saw Luis Avalon, Brandon Cunniff have some success there in the middle innings, because you get rid of Craig Kimbrel and you say, okay, Jim Johnson and Jace Grilly can handle the late innings. And obviously it's a little bit of a gamble there considering what they both did last year. If you feel like your late innings are solid, it still doesn't matter if you can't take, get the outs in the sixth and seventh innings. And, three games doesn't guarantee you anything, but at least they have the feeling, hey, look, maybe Kniff becomes something. And if Luis Avalon is back to where he was in 2013, then that helps bridge the gap a little bit more. And maybe they can get Juan Jaime and some of these other Cody Martin, who was very good in his major league debut the other night. If you just get one extra arm, now all of a sudden, you get that much more depth, the depth that was hurt when they lost Chase Simmons, back in, February when he went down with Tommy John surgery. So they're going to have to mix and match. The biggest concern for this club, though, despite what you saw there in Miami, remains, will they be able to get through those middle innings to protect the lead, to give it to Grilly and Johnson?
All right, well, Mark Bowman, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extra. Talking to New York Harveys with MLB.com's Harveys beat reporter, Anthony Giacomo. This will be outdated by the time we're done, but with the disclaimer that as we speak, it's the second inning. So far, from 40 or so pitches, what have you seen from Matt Harvey in his first major league game?
I am pretty much the same thing we saw all spring training, and that was that he looks very much like the guy that was here 2 years ago. He's throwing 97. He's got that good breaking ball. He's got that good changeup. He's not perfect, but he certainly has the tools to have a very good season as long as he can stay healthy and keep this all together. I mean, if you watch a video of him now, what he's doing today in this game versus, what you saw in 2013, it looks the same. And that's the best thing that the Mets could possibly have happened to them.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's talk about the other 24 Mets. It was really impressive to see Bartolo Colon. It was just fun to see Bartolo Colon because he's just a tremendously fun guy to watch pitch the way he does it now. But it was also really impressive to see what he did on opening day. Is there any reason to think he can't be a pretty good major league starting pitcher yet again this year at his continually advancing age?
I mean, if he did it at age 40/41, I don't see any reason. No, I don't see any reason why he can't do it at 41/42. You know, it's going to be about health for him. It's harder to stay healthy in your 30s than your 20s, and it's certainly harder to stay healthy in your 40s than your 30s. So it's no given that he's going to pitch 200 innings again. That was a major accomplishment last year, and it's tough to assume he'll do that. He'll stay healthy. He'll make 35 starts. He'll avoid the disabled list. Maybe it'd be safer even to pencil a little DL stint in there somewhere, just because, you know, things are going to happen. We saw that with R.A. Dickey a few years ago in New York. While he was pitching well, you know, little things came up, not necessarily with his arm, but with, you know, other body parts and things like that. So, but as long as he is healthy, yeah. I mean, I hesitate to use the word athlete because I know his body type and all that is something of a joke in baseball circles. But, you know, he is a pretty good athlete for what he does and for what he needs to be successful on the mound. He takes good care of his body in terms of what matters for being a pitcher. He is in the weight room all the time, things like that. So, yeah, if he's healthy, he can certainly do that. But that would be the if.
They'll be doing this to some extent, with Harvey. And I would assume they're not going to run DeGrom into the ground either. They'll probably look for a chance to get him opportunities, not to push him too much here and there. Will they also be able to do that with Colon? Is it feasible to have 3/5 of your rotation be guys that you kind of really need to look out for and buy them an extra day or one less inning here and there when you get the chance?
Well, Mets think it is for two reasons. One is that starting pitching depth that we've talked about so many times. You know, they have these guys coming through the system. They have Rafael Montero, who's in the bullpen right now. They have Steven Matz and Noah Syndergaard ready to come up. So they've got guys who they're confident in who can be very good starting pitchers for them this year. So if someone like Bartolo Colon goes in the DL, they don't feel like legitimately they're going to skip a beat. And then the other thing is they still feel, even with the injury to Josh Hedges and even with Vic Black being out, that they have a pretty good bullpen. They have a pretty solid bullpen. They've got quite a few guys in there, like Montero, who I mentioned, like Alex Torres, who they just traded for, and Carlos Torres, who's been successful here in the past. Guys who can go multiple innings. We saw it in game two of the season. Rafael Montero came in a one-run game and gave them two pretty critical innings, so they didn't have to use anybody else. You know, they've got a lot of guys like that. They've got a lot of guys who can take on heavy workloads, and I think they're going to lean on that bullpen a lot this year. So that'll help them. If Matt Harvey needs to go six innings because he threw 100 pitches in those six innings, if Bartolo Colon's out for a while, I think they have guys who can step in. And that, more even than top-end starting pitching, is where their strength lies, is in that pitching depth across the board.
Do you maybe once in a while see – I don't know if Syndergaard would be a guy you'd do this with, but one of those guys from AAA come up just essentially and serve as a sixth starter one time, just give everybody an extra day? Is that the kind of thing that might happen and make sense?
It's possible. You know, they're not going to go to a six-man rotation. We've been down that road with the Mets a few times in recent years, and it's just something they do not want to do. They don't like messing people up. But sure, if you need to call a guy up for a spot start, that's where more than someone like Noah Syndergaard, who I think they would want to bring up to the rotation and have him come up to stay when he does, I could certainly see a guy like Rafael Montero doing that, a guy who's already had some success as a starting pitcher in the big leagues. He's in that bullpen for a reason, and if they need him to come in and spot start one day and give them five innings, similar to what we've seen Carlos Torres do for the Mets in years past, yeah, I don't think they're going to hesitate to do that at all. And really, it's you know, you use the phrase spot starter and you think of some guy who's just in there to soak up innings and, you know, they don't really care necessarily what they get. But that's what I'm talking about, the strength of this team is they think they can bring a guy like Rafael Montero, carry him in the bullpen, and then throw him out as a starting pitcher one day if they need him. And they really won't lose anything in terms of quality from that spot.
You mentioned the bullpen a little bit ago. They're obviously dealing with some issues there. What is the latest on Henry Mejia and what's his status?
Well, he's going to be out. He's going to be out for 10 days. He's going to go without throwing a ball. They want the inflammation in his elbow to calm down. Really, you know, when his elbow started barking, I think a lot of people thought, well, this is Bobby Parnell all over again, maybe even worse, because this is a guy who's had some major, major injury troubles in the past. And I think a lot of people just took it to face value and assumed Henry Mejia is going to be out for a long, long time. And I'm not saying he's out of the woods, but the news he got from his testing up in New York was pretty much the best thing that could have happened. They said it was inflammation. There was no structural damage, no ligament damage, nothing like that. But still, they're going to be careful. And they have that luxury, especially early in the season. They have Jairus Familia, who they can put in the closer's role and be very confident in them. They have some lefties, Jerry Blevins being at the top of that list, who they can mix and match with. He might steal a save or two. And when he is ready to come back, he'll come back. I think they would love for that to be in mid to late April. That might not happen. It might be a little longer than that if he feels any discomfort at all. And by the time he gets back, Bobby Parnell might be ready to come back from the DL as well. You're looking at probably right around a May 1st type of thing with a former Mets closer. So they're going to be very careful with Henry Mejia. They still expect him to be a big part of the bullpen this year. But as for right now, in the very short-term future, he's going to rest.
Will he be handled more gently than a typical closer, even once he comes back as this season goes along? Not just because of this, but this in light of a fairly extensive injury history over the course of his career?
Yeah, well, they did last year. I mean, they were very careful when they moved into the bullpen about pitching him back-to-back at first. Pitching back-to-back-to-back was a huge step that they tried to avoid at all costs, especially early in the season. I think that's going to happen a lot. And I think a lot of people, myself included, aren't necessarily sold on Henry Mejia long-term as a closer here for that reason. If you're going to name one guy and say this is our ninth inning guy, he's getting the ball every time, we've got a close lead in the ninth, you need to be durable. You need to be able to pitch back-to-back. And if you're worried about that, maybe you give the job to someone else, maybe a Bobby Parnell when he comes back, maybe Familia takes this and runs with it. Or maybe, you know, you go with that dreaded closer by committee. Maybe you give it to two guys and whoever's freshest takes the role. But, yeah, Henry Mejia has never really in his career proven that he can stay healthy for any length of time. So until and unless he does that, if we're having this conversation about treating him carefully and giving him extra days off and so on and so forth, maybe long-term the Mets will look seriously in another direction.
Another interesting manager decision, talking about how you handle the closer role, the top of the lineup is pretty interesting, and a lot of the talk has been about who leads off, but the combination of Curtis Granderson leading off here early and David Wright going to the two spot, there's been some conversation. What is the thought process there? I'm assuming this isn't the sabermetric put your best hitter second, but something a little different from that.
Well, it's closer to that than anything else. I mean, some of the controversy was, you know, there's some reports that the front office is just flat out telling Terry Collins who to bat where. That's not true. What is true is that the front office is certainly a part of this conversation. If it were up to Terry by himself, I don't think you would be seeing this lineup with David Wright second and Curtis Granderson first. But he's listening to this, and it's sort of an example of Terry Collins as a change manager. He's willing to take this input at this point in his career. The front office is giving him this data that says, you know, you want your best hitters to bat the most. You want Curtis Granderson up there batting first. More than that, you want David Wright batting second, where maybe he gets an extra at bat every once in a while. Lucas Duda third, Michael Kadire cleanups against right-handed hitters, which is what they've been doing this first week of the season. I think it's something you're going to see a lot this year, as long as it works reasonably well. And, for good reason. The Mets have been using essentially the same type of lineup since Terry Collins has been here, and it hasn't worked out all too well. They've struggled to hit. They've struggled really to hit with power, to do any of that stuff with any consistency. So why not mix it up a little bit? What dictates the fact that David Wright has to be a three hitter? So I kind of like the new lineup. I like what they're doing with it. I like that Terry Collins is showing that willingness to mix it up a little bit, regardless of whose idea it may have been. And we'll see. You know, it didn't work too well the first couple of games of the season, but we'll see. We'll see how it does over a longer stretch of longer sample size here.
All right. Well, Anthony Nocomo, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talk Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter Joe Fusaro. Joe, this is as you wrote today, not really what anybody expected. The risk of making way too much of way too few games. what have we learned? What is there to be taken from the Marlins' surprising 0-3 start?
Yeah, one thing that surprised me, Matthew, was just kind of the lackluster kind of energy. I mean, it was completely like the switch went off after such an upbeat and energized and loose and productive spring training. I think, yeah, obviously Braves have very good pitching, but it just seemed like everything was moving at a slower gear. It just, obviously, they were demoralized in game two in the first inning with Matt Latos. So when you look at that, and, you know, this offense is built to score runs and create excitement, and they put three up in 3 days, and, you know, it just wasn't the team that they were supposedly building towards and being ready. That's kind of what jumped out at me.
So, I mean, look, I'm fully aware that the actual main answer to this is the answer to what has to change is the calendar, is that they'll keep playing and there'll be more games and they'll win games. But what needs to change or what needs to be more effective or better for this club to look more like what they were expecting?
Yeah, I'm going to say the bottom of the order. I mean, I think the top six guys are going to be who they are. But, you know, Saltalamacchia and Echeverria are the two guys who they're the most questions on their offensive production. And they put up a big goose egg in the series. They were 0-for-17 combined with, you know, and Salty going 0-for-7 with 5 Ks. And then even getting Jeff Mathis in there yesterday to, you know, give Salty a break, he went 0-for-2. So, you know, that two spots from your regulars went 0-for-19. And, you know, obviously that ain't cutting it. That's not, you know, allowing the top of the order to turn over with, you know, with guys on base, and it's going to put all the pressure. I think that the top six, I think D's going to be fine. You know, Stanton's going to be fine. You know, the middle of the order also didn't hit in that series. The teams, they're going to walk Stanton. There's no doubt. They're going to, you know, what I was kind of telling Matthew, the game two, when they're down 7-0 in the first inning, and then the Braves want that big 12-2 win, Stanton walked three times in the blowout game. Now, what does that tell you? What that tells me is, The Braves didn't, in a lopsided game, didn't want to give Stanton any chance to even remotely get high. So they're being very careful with him. So that means Morrison, Prado, and Ozuna following are going to have to do their part. And obviously those three didn't do much, and none of them drove in a run in that series. So, you know, until that middle of the order, you know, shows to improve to be the protection, then teams are just going to tippy-toe around Stanton and pitch to him only when they have to.
You brought up two things that I want to address, and the first is the bottom of the lineup. You know, it's two guys there, one who has done it in the past but didn't really do it last year, and one who hasn't done it but everybody, or at least everybody around the Marlins, thinks has potential to do more. This year, what do you think realistically should be expected of those two guys? Again, one who's done it in the past and one who hasn't but people think will in the future. This year, what do you think we should expect?
Yeah, it's really hard to answer because, you know, Salty didn't have the greatest spring, but the end of spring he started squaring some balls up and did some good things. You know, if you just get back to just making contact, reducing the strikeouts and, you know, and using the gaps in Marlins Park, you know, he had 40 doubles 2 years ago. Now, the contact he made was the key one in game one with bases loaded, no out double play, you know, and it was, you know, a devastating part of that game. Now, you know, if Salty gets a hit that day in that situation and he has two RBIs and a game-winning hit on opening day, does that change the whole series? Does that change his outlook? Maybe, you know, you would think that success and confidence, but, you know, here's a guy that, you know, people are going to get restless, and the more he, you know, doesn't produce, there's going to be the pressure to play him less, and you know, that's a big bat, potentially. You know, that's left-handed, you know, switch hitter, obviously, but left-handed power in the lineup without it. So he's a big, big part of this team, and if he doesn't produce, it's going to be, you know, really difficult. Echeverria, on the other hand, you know, he hit the ball. His numbers in spring weren't great, but, you know, he hit a lot of balls really hard at people, had some bad luck. So, you know, he's starting off. If he's hitting eight, we think we talked about this before, it could be hard to produce serious numbers there. And, you know, the athleticism, everything is there that says this guy should produce more than he does, and it's going to be a matter of him doing it, you know. And if he doesn't, then what, you know. So I don't know whether, you know, the fact that the Marlins reached out to him contract-wise and that was put on hold, and whether he's wanting to prove his worth or if he's just, you know, searching for it. But, you know, those two guys are highly valued for this team and highly valuable, and to get zero out of it is going to be really tough.
I didn't – another thing I wanted to touch on that you already mentioned, but I wanted to go into more depth on, I did not see as much of that series as I wanted to just because of timing and things. And so I see, as you mentioned, four walks in three games for Stanton. Watching, how much of that was just guys missing? Because, look, sometimes guys just miss the strike zone. And how much of it did look like, by design, over the course of three games, a concerted effort not to let Stanton be the guy that beat them?
I would say more the starters. I think the Braves had a pretty good game plan. They had a very good. They were very well prepared for this series, no doubt. And, you know, the time that, you know, when Grilly had to get him in the ninth inning, you know, there was a 3-1 count leading off the ninth on opening day in a 2-1 day, you know, game. It looked like Grilly was going to be careful, obviously being careful because one swing we got tie game. He threw a 3-1 fastball that was kind of, you know, shoulder high, but it was in the middle of the plate and Stanton swung. He takes that as probably ball four, and he's on with Morris and, you know, instead, he swings, you know, through that, and it goes full, and then he blows them all away with a full count fastball. So, I think, and that really energized Grilly, who fist pumped and did all the, and that and he went on and just breezed through that inning. So I think it was more the starters, and then it's like game on the line. Hey, you know, and you know, you could see the dynamic when D gets on base. You know that the potential for a lot of fun for Marlins fans. When he gets on base, you saw those elements. And even then, you know, Stanton was walked to load the bases in that game where Salty, you know, hit into the double play. I think I got my math right in that. I might be an inning off. But, no, that was, I think, in a game where Prado, I think, hit into the double play. So teams are going to be really, really careful with him. And I think no one was going to be the one to want to wake him up. So by saying, now, you know, we're up 10 runs, let's, you know, let them hit a little bit. So, yeah, it's something that I think teams, clearly that going into a Marlins series, don't let him beat you. And Morris and company are going to have to make sure that they do their part.
Stanton has displayed a pretty good strike zone in his career. You know, he's definitely not a flailing all or nothing kind of guy. 70 unintentional walks last year, 69 unintentional walks the year before. He's a guy who clearly will take his walks. But you look at some of the really great hitters of recent years. You look at the guys that are going to the Hall of Fame, Pujols, Cabrera. And these are guys who walked more as their careers went on, who made that adjustment as teams started to say, I'm not going to let you beat me. They said, okay, put me on base, and we'll go from there. And that, of course, leads to all kinds of other things. Do you see Stanton continuing to develop in that regard and being a guy more and more? He's not going to be passive, and I'm sure they don't want him to be passive, but really developing that kind of elite strike zone that's one of the things that really separates the very best from the merely very good.
Matthew, yes, I do, and I know he has some strikeouts now. And I anticipated him kind of getting off to maybe a slower April and getting better just because of missed time last year. Now he gets acclimated to all of, you know, his off season wasn't your typical off season when you're letting bones in your face heal. So, you know, all that I anticipate a little slower. But in terms of strike zone discipline, which you're talking about, I think you're going to see him less chasing that slider off the plate. I think you're going to see a lot more awareness. We already are, and I don't know whether he's not. He hasn't been lunging. He hasn't been striking out lunging. He may just get blown away by 97 like a lot of people do. But, you know, he's not doing that, you know, go across the plate and lose his balance on those swings. I think he's recognizing where he's, you know, where he stops. He's working really hard at that, and I do see a guy that's going to walk a lot, but, you know, sometimes taking his own walks. But like I mentioned, you know, the strikeout against Grilly, you know, clearly going a little bit out of the zone, he's certainly the guy that could have tied that up. So you can see why he swung, but, it's going to be real interesting in his development how much, because it's got to be frustrating. You know, you saw it with Pujols, it's got to be frustrating when you're clearly not going to see anything to hit.
Sure, that was the one time he'd get out of his zone was when he knew that nobody else was hitting. One last thing before we're done. It is one start, and nobody wants to make too much of one start, but the guy also didn't have a real good spring. Is there any concern at this point about Matt Latos, or is there nothing but confidence that this guy is going to be the guy they thought they were getting?
No, I think you have wishful thinking that he's going to be fine. But, yeah, there is, you know, concern, and there's going to be a lot of eyes watching Monday in Atlanta when he gets the Braves again, because this guy is a workhorse. This guy goes 5-plus all the time. And in his, you know, first start as a Marlins, out of the game after 2/3 an inning, 10 batters and 7 runs, insists he's fine physically. But here's a guy who, you know, had the knee surgery last year and had an elbow scope in October and moved at a kind of more slower pace in terms of getting him ready for the season in spring training. So, you know, he insists he's healthy. So I think that's the concern, Matthew, not is Latos done. I think it's, is Latos healthy and is he going to be good enough to go as far? Now, I know the organization probably banking walk year, you know, he's playing for a contract. He's going to do all he can to be out there and produce. So you got that going for, you know, for this whole dynamic as well. But, you know, in terms of the whole, the most anticipated start of the season, I think isn't going to be Dan Haren tomorrow to see if they can win. I think it's going to be, it's Matt Latos on Monday, going to resemble more of the Matt Latos he's been through his throughout his career.
All right. Well, Joe Fusaro, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zelek. Todd, there's always a lot to talk about with the Phillies, and we could probably talk about Jonathan Papelbon every week if we wanted to. We certainly can't not talk about him this week. What is he doing? Does he just not care how anybody takes anything? Is he trying to talk his way out of town? These are not extreme comments within the Papelbon canon, but it's just, it's more of it. Is he trying to sort of talk his way out of town?
You know, honestly, I don't know if that's his motivation in these comments. I think he's just being honest. Like, the reporter from the Boston Globe approached him yesterday, said, I don't know what the question was exactly, but he basically, as we know, said, Red Sox are part of me. I don't really feel like a Philly. And I think he's just being honest about it. And he but the problem here is, or the issue here is that it's not, this is not like this is the first time he ever said anything about the Phillies or the organization or the sit or the, or whatever. And people are like, oh, wow. Hey, I didn't know he felt that way. This is kind of a series of comments he's made over time. And, you know, in July, just before the 2013 trade deadline, I talked to him in Detroit and he basically called for changes from the top down in the entire organization. Next July, we're in Milwaukee. We said, would you like to be traded? He's like, why would anybody want to be on this team? And then, of course, he was suspended last September for grabbing himself on the field. And he's made other comments along the way that haven't gotten as much attention. Like he has said, I love being the villain. I love when Phillies fans boo me. You know, so he keeps on kind of adding a little bit of fuel to the fire. And you know, what's interesting is if you really kind of take a step back and look at those comments and what he said, it really makes sense in a lot of ways. The Red Sox drafted him. They developed him. He became a star there. He won a World Series there. He's immensely popular there. He probably will never have to buy a beer or a meal there anytime he goes back to Boston as long as he lives. And he has a lot of great memories about Boston, whereas in Philly, he's come here. They have not won. It's been a disappointment all the way around. And so naturally, he doesn't have those same feelings about the Phillies. So you take a step back, you look at it and go, I kind of see where he's coming from. But then when you look at the bigger picture of all the comments he's made about the Phillies and the organization and in the city, and you go, Jonathan, why do you keep bringing this upon yourself?
From the baseball side, it looks like he's still a pretty good reliever. It certainly seems like there is value there. We've talked about this 100 times, but what do you think are the chances that he's still a Philly, certainly August 1st, but maybe even June 1st? I mean, do you think that he's a guy who gets moved maybe even before the deadline?
I certainly think they would jump at the opportunity to do it if they could, but I guess I get the feeling that a lot of this stuff is going to heat up right before the deadline, once teams really kind of get down to the wire and they feel like they're in the hunt and they feel like they don't have a closer and they know that Papelbon's out there. So
I tend to think it'll run up against that time. You know, it was interesting earlier this week. You know, the Padres make that huge blockbuster trade for Craig Kimbrel. What was interesting to me about it is that they had to take on the entire remainder of Melvin Upton's deal to get him. Plus, they had to give two prospects and a draft pick. And I thought to myself, boy, like, the Phillies would have not required you to take on an extra big deal. They probably would have taken less back to get Papelbon, you know, elsewhere. The Padres, apparently, they expressed minimal interest, or they expressed some marginal interest in him a few months ago, but nothing in the last few months, which I thought was interesting, because if the Padres were looking at a closer, certainly Kimbrel is far and away the best in baseball, so I'm not saying that these two are equal on equal footing. But, you know, if you're going, okay, we can get Craig Kimbrel, pay $43.5 million, give up two prospects and draft pick, or we can pay Jonathan Papelbon $26 million over the next 2 years and maybe only give up a prospect or two. I just thought it was interesting that they weren't interested in him. But so that kind of gets me to feel that, you know, they might wait towards more close to the July deadline to get things done if they can.
Meanwhile, his setup man continues to search for his form. Let's overreact to a whole bunch of games that don't matter and only one that does. What's the concern level about Ken Giles right now?
The concern level is that last season when he came up, he was a strikeout machine, tremendous strikeout-to-walk ratio. It was pumping fastballs on a bad day, 98, 99, maybe a 97 on a really bad day. But he would be hitting that 99, 100-mile-an-hour mark pretty consistently, it seemed. And this spring, he was in the low 90s, touched 95 a couple times. And then yesterday, he was in the 94, 95-mile-an-hour range, hit 96 a couple times. But so the velocity is down. Which, you know, maybe it takes him a while to get his arm strength up. We don't have anything to really go back on in terms of his major league career to say, yeah, he's usually takes him a while to get his velocity up. But the concerning part is that he's just all over the strike zone. I think in spring training, he walked 13 batters in 14 innings, struck out 15, whereas last year it was he barely seemed to walk anybody and was striking out two batters an inning. And the same thing kind of happened yesterday. He walked three batters, forced in a run, and couldn't get out of the inning. So he says he's healthy. Ryan Sandberg said Giles is telling us that he's healthy. He had the back issue the last week of camp. He insists that's not the reason. He says he just needs to make adjustments. He needs to mentally get in the right frame of mind, whatever that means. So that's certainly what they're hoping because, you know, I wrote a story entering the season and how he is kind of the key symbolic piece of this rebuilding program, plan. Because he could potentially be a closer for one of the most dominant closers in baseball for several years, and they're hoping that he's that guy down the road. But the first, you know, Wednesday night's example or outing, and then, you know, spring training certainly has raised a few eyebrows for sure.
Meanwhile, there's not really any worry about Cole Hamels, but I just wonder. A guy's been doing it this long and continues to have trouble the first month of the season. He's got 6 weeks to get ready. What is it that causes a guy who has all spring and all winter to get ready to have a hard time pitching well in the first month of the season?
Yeah, that thing I can't explain. You know, there's been a couple springs where Phillies people, like his first bullpen session, like, oh my gosh, Cole Hamels looks unbelievable. He looks to be in mid-season form. Like, so it's not a matter of him coming in camp out of shape. In 2009, after the World Series, that did happen to him, and he really struggled coming out of the chute. But there, like I said, there have been springs where not only Philly's front office personnel, but scouts from other teams go, oh man, is Cole Hamels going to have a big year? He looks outstanding. And this is like his second start in March. So he seems to be prepared. I don't know if it's the cold weather or what, but for whatever reason, jitters maybe, which would be surprising considering how much postseason experience he's had. But for whatever reason, April has not been very kind to him.
Excuse me, goodness. One other guy, we talk about all these trades, and I brought this up once or twice, but we talk about all these possible trade guys. We talk about Papelbon, we talk about Hamels, talk about how much they'd love to move Howard and whether they could move Utley. after a very small number of games, Carlos Ruiz is hitting the ball well. Carlos Ruiz is, to my eye, a pretty good hitter for a catcher when he's healthy. Now, he's not young. He's not exactly a force on the base paths, but he's a pretty good offensive catcher. Is he trade bait? Is he somebody they're not looking to move? Is he somebody that they don't get calls on? It just seems weird that as much as everybody else gets talked about, he doesn't seem to get talked about as one of the trade options.
Yeah, he definitely does fly under the radar quite a bit, but I do think that they would be willing to move him if a team suffered a major injury to a catcher today or tomorrow or this next week, and they thought that catcher would be out long term. I definitely think that the Phillies are willing to listen. Now, the problem is they really don't have anybody that can be an everyday catcher right now, so they would really take a huge step back. And, you know, all things said and done, does it really matter in this season? Probably not, but they also want to put forth, a decent lineup every night as much as they possibly can. But that said, I do think if the right deal came along and they could make a trade for Carlos Ruiz, that they would make that. I think that that's a guy to watch come July. You know, if a team needs some catching help, I think he's a prime candidate for it.
All right. Well, Todd Zielecki, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.